Okay, so let me start. So thank you very much for introduction for Bawasan. I'm very happy to be here. I'm still trapped by time difference. We have a time difference of about 16 hours. Now it's 2:30 in the morning. Today I'd like to talk about the hyperfine interaction for lifting a so-called spin blockade in coupled double quantum devices. The effect of the hyperfine coupling is one of the most important issues to be studied in the context for a spin-based quantum information processing with the semiconductor nanostructures, because the effect of hyperfine coupling can significantly dominate the dephasing, spin dephasing time. And in this work, we use a semiconductor quantum dot to study the influence of a hyperfine interaction between a single electron spin and nuclear spin ensembles in semiconductor quantum dot systems. In double dot system holding just two electrons, the formation of a spin triplet state having two polar spins in two dots can give rise to so-called Pauli-type spin blocking, because the transition of an electron spin will be blocked by Pauli effect. And this kind of a spin triplet state is an excited state, but can stay long because of the very long spin relaxation time. And it dominates the electron transport. And then this kind of a spin blockade can be lifted by inducing the singlet and triplet transitions by means of the interaction with the nuclear spins. So in this talk, I'll classify the two regimes. One is, the first one is the regime when we have a pretty large exchange energy, or the difference between the spin singlet and triplet state as compared to the statistical fluctuation of nuclear spins. And the other regime is in the opposite case, when the exchange energy is pretty much small as compared to the fluctuating hyperfine field energy. For the first regime, I show that the singlet triplet transition will be caused by a flip-flop type hyperfine interaction when the exchange energy is equivalent to the Zeeman energy. Then the flip-flop type interaction is activated. And we use this kind of transition to measure actually the exchange energy. And to modulate the exchange energy or conditions, we use a potential detuning, or the degree of the asymmetry between the two quantum dots. And then I'll also discuss about somewhat about the resonance effect on this hyperfine interaction. In the second case, I will mainly discuss the influence of the hyperfine fluctuations to mix up the electron spin singlet and triplet states. This can also give some partial lifting of the hyperfine spin blockade in double dot systems. So here is a list of my collaborators. Kitamura and Kodera are both my graduate students, and they are main contributors to this work. And Tokura is an entity theorist, and Keiji Ono used to be in my group, now is working at the weekend. Now, in the quantum dot systems made from a compound semiconductors, in our discussion, there are always some competing energy scales among the hyperfine energy, exchange energy, and Zeeman energy. We studied these competing the effect with the inter-dot tunnel coupling, detuning, as the parameters in a coupled quantum systems. Here I will show you some typical energy scale for these three the energies. The fluctuating of fluctuation of a nuclear spin can give say, some kind of a characteristic energy defined by E sub m, which is given by this G nu b times the fluctuating nuclear spin field. Nuclear spin field is given by the Hyperfine constant divided by the square root of number of nuclei. In our quantum dot systems, actually the material is gallium arsenide. Gallium 71 and 69, arsenic 75, all of them have the nuclear spin of 3 halves. And the size of our quantum dot is just 50 nanometers in diameter. So there must be 10 to the 5 nuclei which can interact with an electron spin. Then we can evaluate the fluctuating nuclear spin field of order of a 16 millitesla. This gives a characteristic energy of the nucleus in fluctuation of 0.2 microelectron volts, which is pretty small. And exchange term. Exchange energy is a function of the Hopping matrix element between two dots T and interdot Coulomb energy and intradot Coulomb energy and the tuning, a potential tuning between the two dots. And for the zero detuning, for the symmetric two-dot systems, this exchange term is the Hubbard exchange energy, which is given by 40 squared over U inter minus U inter. And if we are close to the resonance condition, so then this J is more or less the square root 2 times T. And when we are away from the resonance, this J changes the inverse of the detuning delta or the square inverse of the detuning delta. And the final one is the Zeeman term, which is given by the simple expression. And we can get the 0.13 microelectron volt, which is equivalent to the, more or less equivalent to the nuclear spin, fluctuating nuclear spin energy, for about 10 millitesla. So then a 10 or 20 millitesla is some kind of a typical magnetic field which can compete with a nuclear spin fluctuation. Now, okay, the what is actually the case when we have a the competition between the hyperfine interaction for a singlet and triplet states. And we define J as the difference between the singlet and triplet states. And particularly, when this exchange term is greater than the fluctuating hyperfine and the, energy, so we can forget the contribution of the hyperfine fluctuations. Then we have the triplet states and the singlet states. They are both excited states. And when we apply the magnetic field, the triplet state will split into the three sublevels. And one of these sublevels become degenerated with the singlet state at certain magnetic field, which is actually 0.4, 0.5 tesla. And then at this degenerate point, the flip-flop type hyperfine interaction is activated to induce a frequent transition between a spin singlet and triplet state. Then spin blockade is actually lifted because of the transition from a triplet state to the singlet state. And on this kind of a process, we observe some bistable behaviors and oscillations of the current, which is associated with the dynamical nuclear spin polarization. And then this means that when we observe something different, something strange or critical associated with the nucleus, dynamical nuclear spin polarization, we can measure the actual exchange energy. And on the other hand, when the exchange energy is smaller than the fluctuating hyperfine interaction energy, singlet and triplet mixing occurs by the fluctuating nuclear spin field. Then, if the Zeeman energy is smaller than this fluctuating nuclear spin energy, the singlet and triplet states are mixed up. So then the spin blockade is usually partially lifted by this mixed states. However, when the Zeeman energy is greater than the nuclear field energy, so then the two of the triplet states can not mix up with the one of the triplet and also the singlet. So then this spin blockade will be restored again. Okay. Now we think about actually the case in a realistic double dot system. We have two quantum dots coupled to each other, having one electron in each dot. If the double dot is symmetric or the tuning zero, the ground state is this singlet state, and located above, just by the 4t squared over u, we have a spin triplet state. And the somewhat above, by the single particle level spacing, we have a doubly occupied singlet state, having two electrons, antipolar spins in one of the two dots. Then we introduce some detuning, which gives an energy difference between the two spins in two dots. And then, for the small detuning, the singlet is still the ground state. And this is singlet having two electron spins in one of the two dots is pulled down because of this detuning. And for more detuning, this doubly occupied singlet state takes the place of the ground state. And then the first excited state is now the triplet state. The singlet state, which used to be the ground state, is now the second excited state because these two singlet states are repulsive each other. So then, there must be some resonance between the two singlet states in between. So here is some kind of a potential diagram changing with the detuning. When there is no detuning, we have a ground state of a singlet, and the excited state is a triplet. And far above, we have a doubly occupied singlet state. Now we increase the detuning. This doubly occupied singlet comes down. And then the resonance occurs between the two singlet states. But this resonance does not influence the triplet state at all. And then we have a resonance. Then, if we increase the detuning more, the ground state is now the doubly occupied singlet. The first excited state is the triplet state. And if then here is the regime of the so-called spin blockade. Now this triplet is the first excited state, but stays long as an excited state and blocks the current. And when we increase the tuning more, we have another triplet state having well above because of the single particle level spacing. This triplet state comes down and becomes, there is some resonance between the two triplet states again. This is triplet-triplet resonance, and this triplet resonance can lift the spin blockade. And the resonance, however, does not influence at all the singlet state. Okay. And so here we have a singlet-singlet resonance. Here we have a triplet-triplet resonance. And then, when we say the small detuning, we are working here in the regime. So then the singlet triplet level spacing is a bit greater. As the detuning is increased, this separation goes down more and more. And if we say large detuning, we are here in the region closer to the second resonance. Good. Now let's start the experiment. This is a very typical experimental data of the current versus bias voltage for the vertically coupled double dot system when the spin blockade is working. The spin blockade gives a suppression of current here. There is a small leakage current, mainly due to the inelastic cotonnement. And this spin blockade region is only lifted when there is a spin transition of electronic system from the single triplet state. And we say that this lifting is caused by the coupling to nuclear spins. We control this kind of a lifting of spin blockade using a source drain voltage as a parameter. So then, this then when the exchange energy is greater than the fluctuating hyperfine energy, we can switch on and off the hyperfine interaction using a magnetic field. So as I discussed in the previous graph, when we apply the magnetic field, one of the triplet sublevels and the singlet are degenerated. At this point, when we sweep the magnetic field, the leakage current shows a critical jump and then stays more or less constant at the high current level. When we sweep down, there is some bistable behavior or some hysteresis loop. And then the current goes down to the lower level. This kind of behavior occurs when we sweep the magnetic field only slowly, because we need a process to dynamically pump the nuclear spin or polarize nuclear spin. So then, when we are working, this hysteresis loop is a kind of signature where the dynamical pumping is going on. At the high current level, we say that the nuclear spin is more or less polarized. In the low current level, nuclear spin is depolarized. If we stay here somewhat in the hysteresis loop region, if we wait here, the nuclear spin is gradually pumped up. So then the current level is recovered from the low level to the high level after some recovery, characteristic recovery time. So then this recovery is a measure how much the nuclear spin is polarized at the initial point. And to explore the how much.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So this may be a naive question.
Yeah.
So the in this hysteretic region,
yes.
You have two sort of dynamically metastable steady states,
yes,
if you like. But not quite metastable, I guess. Why is the recovery up rather than down?
This hysteresis loop is a hysteretic loop size is determined by the two competing processes. One is the pumping of nuclear spin. The other is the decay of the nuclear spin. So in this region, pumping is wins the game. So anyway, when we are closer to this the rise, we are closer to this degenerate point. When we are here, we are away from the degenerate point. The pumping power is reduced when we are away from the degenerate point. But decay always going on, because this is due only due to the nuclear spin system. So then we usually observe only the pump up. But maybe if we sip quickly, and if we are here, there must be some jump down. And we later will show you this observation of a metastable state.
Okay. erratic behavior doesn't have anything to do with night shifts induced by the...
Ah, no, this is not the case. Night shift can influence, I think. Mm-hmm. There must be some feedback process to the nucleus, but we have no idea about that as far as
you
the
experimental.
No, experimentally, no. Experimentally, we can see, but we cannot identify. This is maybe the correct
thing.
I have a little question.
Yeah.
So the nuclear spins are reasonably flip-flopping due to dipolar interaction
yes.
over some time scale, which
yeah.
is fairly long.
Yeah.
Now, this systemic behavior somehow must depend on that time scale also, right? I mean, so you are sweeping much slower than that time scale. That's why you see
that's right, that's right.
Otherwise, the nuclear magnetic field is completely random.
That's right, that's right.
And so that's where that minute is coming.
Yeah.
That
when we sweep very quickly, the hysteretic loop size will reduce and some gradual. And to see the influence of nuclear spin, we can use a so-called NMR technique. So this, we put some kind of three-time coil on top of the dot and apply and inject the RF power. So then if the RF frequency is in resonance with the nuclear spin, this strongly depolarizes the nuclear spin systems. So then we can immediately go down to the low level. And if we wait, we need a longest time to go back to the high current level. So then experiment is carried out in an easy way. We are here first at the fully polarized nuclear spin condition, and we, by activating the hyperfine coupling, and we switch off the hyperfine coupling and wait some time. Before we do not wait for a long time, we irradiate the RF the power to the coil, and this the RF frequency is in resonance with the nuclear spin. The nuclear spin is immediately depolarized, and we need the maximum recovery time to come back to the high current level. This is very rough picture of our sample. We have a sample here. This is a coil, one-time coil, actually, we use. Very simple experiment. Here is the schematic picture we expect. We measure the recovery time as a function of the RF frequency. And at some frequency, we should see the sharp peak due to the resonance of our nuclei. So here is an experimental data. We see three peaks at three different frequencies due to the transition between the two neighboring two levels for the among the four states due to the quadrupolar splitting. And we also see the two photon process more or less in the frequency twice as much. So then resonance occurs. If you work very carefully, you can even observe the radio oscillations of the nuclear spins. But we do not go into this observation. So then, now the introduction is over. I come into my main discussion. And for this experiment, we usually use this kind of a vertical coupled double dots. In this pillar, we have a double dots which are vertically coupled. And we have some gate in the surrounding. For this device, the potentials on the two dots are more or less equivalently varied. It's very difficult to adjust the symmetry or the asymmetry of the two dots. But if you separate the gates into the two parts, there is a way to tune the asymmetry of the two dots in somewhat in arbitrary way. I do not go into the details. Using this technique, we can move from the symmetric region with the delta zero to the asymmetric region, having the expect the so-called spin blockade. Now the two electron doubly occupied the singlet state is more or less degenerate with the another singlet having one electron in each dot. So here is a singlet resonance point. And this is the evidence of that kind of a tuning. This is a so-called the measurement of the Coulomb diamond as a function of source drain voltage and gate voltage. At the zero bias voltage, we see a well-closed, the so-called the diamond-shaped regions. So the symmetry of this kind of diamond is a signature of that. We have actually the symmetric the condition. When we introduce the condition, the diamond-shaped region is not well closed. There is some the region to the right of this second diamond where the current is strongly suppressed. This is the region of the so-called spin block gate. Okay, now we are ready for the experiment. And if we measure a sweep current along the source drain voltage axis, we have a very simple picture. We have a singlet resonance point here, and to the right of this resonance, we have a region of spin block gate. To the left of this resonance, we have a region of so-called Coulomb block gate. This is a charge effect. And this block gate is lifted when the lowest 1S state is above the chemical potential of the drain. So we have to work in this spin block gate region. And when we change the source drain voltage in this region, we can change the detuning between the two potentials. Okay. So now I say, we are now working in this regime close to the singlet resonance, but still in the spin block gate region. When we increase the detuning, the singlet triplet level spacing goes down. This is the exact calculation result. In the small detuning, it's proportional, more or less proportional to the 1 over the delta, the detuning, and it goes down more abruptly when we are away from this singlet resonance. And here, the resonance point, the separation between the singlet and triplet states is enhanced pretty much. So we need a large magnetic field to get the degenerate point between one of the triplet states and the singlet states. When we are away, when we have a larger detuning, when we apply more voltage, this separation goes down. We need only a small magnetic field. So here is a set of the experimental data. We see a hysteresis loop for various source drain voltage. We apply minus 2 millivolts. The large detuning, the singlet triplet separation is reduced. We need a small magnetic field. Then the current jumps up and stays constant. Another jump here, but we do not discuss here. And when we sweep down, we have a hysteresis loop. When we reduce the source drain voltage to approach the resonance point, this hysteretic loop shifts to the high magnetic field. The onset, the magnetic field increases more abruptly when we approach the resonance point. So we say the shift of the threshold magnetic field to the high magnetic field is observed when we are closer to the singlet resonance point. And also, the current level of this hysteresis loop, high current level, also increases when we approach the resonance point. And finally, I don't know whether this English is correct or not, three stable state or the metastable states is observed when we have a large detuning or away from the resonance point. Okay, when we plot the threshold magnetic field as a function of the detuning measured from the resonance point, this most of the experimental data falls on the line showing the 1 over the tuning. And it deviates somewhere here and somewhere here near resonance. Near resonance, it goes up very much. This seems too consistent with the calculation in the regime near resonance. Okay. Now we discuss the increase of the spin block gate leakage current due to the double resonance, which we call. At this resonance, the two singlet states are equidistant from the triplet states. So then the two resonances occur at more or less at the same time. One resonance is the singlet, between a singlet and one of the triplet, and the other is the one of the other triplet and the singlet state. So then the resonance occurs at the same time here at this point. And this, we have a singlet here, upper level, and a singlet here, to the lower level. So this gives, accelerates the lifting of the spin blockade to generate the higher current we expect. This is the plot of the current hysteresis, again, but with the sweeping the source drain voltage at the fixed magnetic field. So you see, it's complicated. The parameters are the magnetic field. You see, there are some hysteresis loop, and we see two stable states, high current level and low current level. This compares to the hysteresis loop we observed for sweeping of the magnetic field. And also, there is another intermediate stable state, which is only observed for the source drain voltage, the large source drain voltage, or away from the resonance points. And the high current level always goes up when we approach the singlet resonance. And the another effect to accelerate the lifting of spin blockade is due to the shorter relaxation time of nuclear spins when the system is in the more accelerated electron transport regime. If we have the electron spins are going through the double dots, this seems to make shorter the spin relaxation time for nuclear spins systems. Okay, this is some magnified plot of the observation of a metastable state. So when we sweep the magnetic field, the current level stays at the low level and jumps up. This current level sometimes it goes up to the highest level and comes down and to the highest level and shows some hysteresis loop, and it stays at this intermediate state and comes down to the lowest level. So this actually occurs when the detuning is pretty large. We are now doing some very much hand-waving discussion. This kind of a metastable state will be associated with the different species of the nuclei, arsenic 75 and the gallium 69 or 71. The cross section of the hyperpi interaction is pretty much different between arsenic and the gallium. This is well known for the NMR studies, but the discussion is still hand waving. We are not very sure. I believe most of the problems which we do not understand can be solved here by distinguished theories. So I brought mainly the data which we do not understand quite well. This is one point which we do not understand quite well. We got this data very recently, just 1 or 2 weeks ago. And another problem which we do not understand is the current level in the hysteresis loop. We said this jump or rise of the current occurs due to the transition between the spin and the singlet and triplet states, motivated by flip-flop type hyperpi interaction. But if you look at the scale of the current, this is on the order of picoamps. So then, how many flip-flop events we need per second is easily calculated. We need a 10 to the 7 flip-flop events per second. So then the nuclear spin can be polarized quite easily. And if you take into account the lifetime of nuclear spin on the order of minutes, this 10 to the 7 must be multiplied by 1,000. So in total, we have a 10 to the 10 flopped nuclear spins. So I said that in our quantum dot, we have at most 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 nuclear spins. So then this, from this comparison, we can easily expect that our nuclear spins must be fully polarized. Then the nuclear spin field must be 5 Tesla. However, what is observed from this, the width of the hysteresis loop is the estimate of the nuclear spin polarization, just 4%. We are trapped by this contradiction. We have to solve this problem, but we need to have a very large gain of electron spin current after the flip-flop interactions, maybe 10,000 or 100,000.
But you also have spin relaxation which is being achieved by
dipole.
So this will reduce.
Yeah, but still on the order of minutes in our measurements. We actually measure the T1 time of the nuclear spin. So this is the longest the relaxation will be 2 or 3 minutes. The shortest relaxation time is 1 minute. Still very long. So to explain everything with the reduced nuclear spin relaxation, we need the T1 time of nuclear spin on the order of less than milliseconds, which is pretty small.
Why can't it be that you're polarizing nuclei outside of the quantum world?
Yeah, this can diffuse outside the quantum world. This is well discussed by Shedong Fu and the colleague of the Shankar. Even when you take into account that the diffusion is very slow. Mm-hmm. It's pretty difficult to explain everything.
Yeah, the problem is the huge discrepancy. This is almost 2 orders of magnitude.
Okay.
I agree with you, that's hard to see. Coming from this sort of consideration.
Yeah.
Maybe some process has been neglected, but I think.
But I think it's any kind of these experiments on the hyperfine interaction of quantum dots, the observed current level is on the order of a couple of hundred femtoamps or 1 picoamps in the Delft group and Harvard group. But this already gives a quite large number of the nuclear spin to be polarized. But we do not discuss very much. We do not declare very much about these things because we do not understand quite well. Okay.
So we appreciate the clear.
Now we come to the other region. We are closer to the triplet resonance. We introduce more the tuning, and then the 2p state will come down, and 2 triplet states can be in resonance. Now we must be in this region. Then, because of the large detuning, the singlet triplet separation is reduced pretty much, actually. And here is some kind of large-scale plot of the differential conductance as a function of torsion voltage and gate voltage. You see these vertical lines are all the lines for resonance between the two levels. So we can draw the region of the Coulomb blockade something like this. 0 electron state and 1 electron state, 2 electrons. If you look at carefully the data, there are very faint lines for us to guide the Coulomb blockade region due to the inelastic cotonium. So then, this is a line of the first resonance of the 1 electron state between the one electron in the oneness or in the right dot or left dot and that in the right dot. So then the detuning is zero. And this is the point of resonance between the two singlet states. So here is the resonance between the two triplet states. Here is another resonance between the two triplet states with the different orbital states and the two singlet states with the associated with the 2p states. When we zoom in this region, we have a spin blockade region terminated by the resonance between the two triplet states. So then this is a picture of the spin blockade, but if the 2p state comes down, the triplet state will be lifted by transferring one upstream electron to the 2p state in the other dot. So we work in this yellow region anyhow. And when we sweep the source drain voltage, we have a Coulomb blockade region and spin blockade region, very sharp resonance peak due to the resonance between the two triplet states. And here is the spin blockade region. And this is a magnified plot of the spin blockade. The leakage current is on the order of 400 picoamps. When we fix the voltage here and measure the leakage current as a function of magnetic field, the leakage current stays at the 400 femtoamps for the magnetic field up to 12 millitesla. And above this field, this goes down to more than, somewhat less than to the half, and stays constant above the, more or less above the 40 or 50 millitesla. And if you compare this magnetic field or nuclear spin field, the 20 millitesla is the fluctuating nuclear spin field. So this high level current is due to the lifting of the spin blockade due to the mixing between the spin singlet and triplet states motivated by nuclear spin or hyperfine field fluctuations. And above the 40 millitesla stays constant because the two of the triplet sublevels are away from the singlet states. So fluctuation of hyperfine field no more works. This is easy to understand. And if we apply the in-plane magnetic field, we observe the growth, increase of this triplet resonance peak and broadening also the triplet resonance peak. If when you usually apply the in-plane magnetic field, wave function are squeezed inside each dot, and the interdot tunnel coupling is reduced pretty much. But our magnetic field is not such a high magnetic field. But this behavior is completely opposite to the case we usually expect. The interdot tunnel coupling is anyway increased with increasing magnetic field. And we observe also that some kind of a phonon sidebound, which also increases as the interdot tunnel coupling is increased. When we plot the peak current as a function of the magnetic field, this current goes up and increases reach the level of about 50 picoamps, starting with the 20 picoamps. It's increased by a factor of 2.5. This red data is the current for the singlet signal resonance, which is more or less constant with magnetic field. So then we do again the hand waving discussion. When we say the triplet states, two different triplet states will participate in the resonance process. The first triplet state has one electron in one dot, the other electron in the other dot. These two electrons feel the different fluctuating nucleus in field. On the other hand, the other triplet has two electrons in one of the two dots. These two electrons feel the same fluctuation of a nucleus in field. So if you calculate, if you think about the difference of the fluctuating nucleus spin field, we always have some finite component in x, y, z direction of nucleus spin field fluctuation. However, in this case, there is no such components. So we say, if the nucleus spin fluctuation of the nucleus spin is important, the triplet state having two electrons in two quantum dots fields the XY component of the fluctuating nucleus spin field. So then the triplet state must be mixed up. But this is not the case for the other singlet state. Ever when the Zeeman is greater, so this is, sorry, this is opposite. Zeeman is greater, we have no such mixing effect. So any of the triplet states are well defined. So that if we think about the overlap of the two triplet states, and by assuming the conservation of the Z component of the spin, when we put one electron in one of the triplet states, the possibility is one-third. And this electron can find the partner to conserving the Z component with a probability of one-third. So then if you multiply three, the total is one-third. But if the Zeeman is important, the probability is one. Each triplet can always find a good partner with a probability of 100%. However, this is not the case for the two singlet states. You can forget all of these kind of the mixing effects. So then we can reasonably expect the factor three for the change of the peak or for increase of the resonance in the current. So now I come to my summary. These discussions are all hand-waving. We have no good theory for that. And we study the hyperfine interaction for lifting spin blockade in double quantum dot system for the small detuning regime where the singlet triplet separation is greater than the fluctuating nucleus spin field. The flip-flop interaction causes the singlet triplet transition to lift the spin blockade when the Zeeman energy is equivalent to the singlet triplet separation. And the threshold magnetic field is a good measure of the singlet triplet separation, which gradually increases with decreasing the detuning and more abruptly when the detuning is closer to the resonance singlet resonance point. And this leakage current measured in the spin blockade regime also increases approaching this singlet resonance point. And interestingly, away from the resonance, pre-stable leakage current is observed. This can be due to the different kinds of the hyperfine interactions. We are somewhat moderate here. And in the other regime where the detuning is pretty large, we observe the reduction of the leakage current when the Zeeman energy is greater than the fluctuating hyperfine energy. And the triplet resonance is enhanced as well by the Zeeman. Thank you very much.
So can I go back to a cartoon on the previous, just for a reality check? So is that supposed to be triplet 1s 2p on the right hand side there, or am I?
1s. Triplet D, sorry, this is triplet 1s 2p.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry.
So those wave functions, 1s and 2p, in some sense sample different nuclei within the quantum dot, right?
Yes, yes. So yeah, you expect there are also some difference.
Yeah, but much smaller. And I didn't follow this completely, so are you saying that your experimental results are qualitatively consistent with no difference in this case, or Can you infer something about how different they are?
Experimental data. You mean? Mm-hmm. Experimental data. This is the triplet resonance current peak at the zero magnetic field. We observe in some 20 picoamps.
So it's not a factor of 3?
Not factor of 2.5.
Okay.
2.5 is closer to 3.
Okay.
We say, experimentally, we say it's consistent with theory. Rigorously, we cannot say. Lateral dots, they also, you can reach those regimes.
Both regimes?
I'm not pretty sure.
Because the confinement of all states is much stronger still in this vertical.
Yeah, yeah.
So the exchange splitting is also much
larger. Yes. Much larger. Yes. Yeah, that's right. The lateral dot devices, this kind of hysteretic loop has never been observed. What is observed is the instability of the leakage current. So
this means this is the large detune.
Yeah, large detune. That's right.
Coming back to the discrepancy that you pointed out about, the argument shows if you just look at your current from the bistability,
yes,
that all the nuclei in your dot should be polarized.
Oh.
Dynamically polarized, which gives a 5 Tesla field, but your instability is taking place over, I guess, half a Tesla or something like that.
Yeah.
So less than half a Tesla,
0.2 Tesla.
Is there any way of directly measuring the nuclear polarization? Is there an indirect measurement in that dot?
Yeah, this is the indirect measurement. We are not sure. But
is it really 5 Tesla?
5 Tesla is far away.
Yes. Yeah. The difference is so large what I'm asking is that anywhere knowing that you have a 5 Tesla nuclear field, this goes back to the question Alan was asking, night shift or something else, to see whether really there is a 5 Tesla field that the nuclear is producing.
Yeah.
I can't think of any because if the electrons are localized, you can't really use the standard techniques or users, but that would be.
As far as the polarization of nuclear spin is concerned, there is some optical studies to see the external transition energies. So their data is all more or less the same as our data. The polarization is just 5%, at most 20%, not 100%.
Right. So it's a theory of this current that. There's something missing.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
And
the problem is in the top part. The bottom part is okay.
Okay, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right.
So
I don't think there's a high Tesla field.
Yeah.
So let me ask you about the theoretical landscape.
Yes.
I don't know all the literature. I know Nazarov has done something on this problem, right? Is it mainly him or Shankar? Have you done on?
No, Shivam, who is looking at it? This is a question. I don't know if he has looked at this problem or not. He has looked at his diffusion question.
That's right.
But that doesn't solve the problem. We only need to talk to him, but it doesn't.
Not the electron current level, current is concerned.
So what would, let's say, a simple rate equation theory, assuming that you only polarize nuclei inside the quantum dot, means you're in a low current state and then you jump up to a high current state?
Yes.
But maybe the high current value would be smaller than what you really measure.
Much smaller, I think. Much, much smaller. As long as you assume the T1 time for nuclear spin on the order of minutes, if you assume it's microseconds or 0.1 milliseconds, you can raise the current, but not the minutes for T1.
What is tau length that you use in the system?
Nuclear.
Multiplied by tau n. What is it, tau n?
The We did not solve the rate equations quite well. So tau n is what is actually measured is 2.5 minutes.
What is this time?
T1 time.
Nuclear T1 time.
I have a...
I mean, it's tau n, just nuclear T1 time, right?
Nuclear T1 time.
We're calling it tau n, but it's nuclear
T1. T1 time can be measured not quite easily, but somewhat easily. This is... what is this? Sorry, this is not this. This is the actual measurement of T1 time. We measure the recovery time as a function of the whole time where the autofine coupling is switched off. Then the recovery time changes as a function of the whole time. From this change, we can evaluate the T1 time of about the 2.5 minutes. So this is a pretty precise experiment to evaluate T1 or T tau n.
But 2.5 minutes is not 1,000 seconds.
Not 1,000 seconds.
So there is a factor of 10 right there. I mean, this is more like 100 seconds.
Yeah.
So that brings down your 5 Tesla to half a Tesla. So, I mean, maybe the way you think of handle was just too much. I mean, because if you go back, your estimate assumed that to be a factor of 1,000.
Yeah.
But 2.5 minutes.
100 seconds.
Right. So that brings down your 5 Tesla, 0.5 Tesla right there.
Yeah. It saves the one order of magnitude.
Right. So it's a factor of 5, which I would say here in experimental agreement.
Yeah. But this means 10 to the 9.
It's
still 1,000.
Yes. Because so you have to increase this n somehow. I think Alan's original answer is right. Somehow many more nuclear involved.
Maybe somehow. Maybe simply because you're driving it.
Yeah. Yeah. That somehow.
In the steady state, you have to solve a steady state problem with nuclei coupled to the other nuclei.
Yeah. Because you know, this thing we all do it. I agree also to say, well, there's that many nuclei in the dot. It is in a non-equilibrium situation, it's not really clear. The electron is driving a certain number of nuclei.
Mm-hmm.
That number you can get from the wave function of the electron somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But then those nuclei couple the nuclei outside them.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some coupling that may go on. I mean, quantitative is much less, I agree, because nuclear-nuclear coupling is dipolar.
Yes.
But everything is being driven, so I do not think anybody has looked at the problem of electron coupled to the nuclei in the dot, then those nuclei coupled to the nuclei still outside.
Mm-hmm.
That's a simple problem. If you,
yes.
If you have a dot which is like a pancake,
mm-hmm.
and it has a radius, if you introduce such a quantity as spin diffusion coefficient in the bulk material, then when you estimate the relaxation time, you take d, this spin diffusion,
yep.
relaxation rate, you take this d and divide by the larger size of the dot, not by the width, not by some combination of not by the volume to the power 1/3, but by the largest size.
Yes.
And then it means that if you calculate the effective number of nuclei, this will not be the number of nuclei inside your pancake, but this will be the number of nuclei in the volume, which is larger as the aspect ratio of your device.
Yeah.
Then you can get probably another factor of 10 quite easily.
Mm. I think you see our dot is has the shape of pillar. So the our geometrical diameter is just the 0.5 micron. Effective wave function diameter is 0.05 micron. If we think about the full size of the dot, we can get the factor of 100 at most. All of the materials or nuclei are polarized. So, but we still have a...
If you have a pillar, when the diffusion starts,
the perpendicular direction.
Until it comes to the end of the
pillar. Yeah.
So in one dimension, the diffusive spreading does not give you the relaxation rate.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you get three-dimensional system and then spreading into three dimensions, you get real relaxation.
Yeah.
In 1D, you would simply polarize all the nuclei, or infinite time, all the nuclei in the internal energy system. So here you would polarize, you would have to polarize all the nuclei inside the pillar before the relaxation into the bottom of the star.
Our quantum world is the quantum world has a site of the 100 angstrom, 120 angstrom. So this means we need the 1 micron
in
height. 1 micron, then factor. No, sorry, 10 micron. Factor 1,000.
Here is 10 microns.
Well, what height is 1 micron? But the substrate, we have a substrate. Substrate is very big. 400 micron.
Polarize everything in the substrate. What I'm saying is that you would have to polarize everything inside the pillar.
Yes, yes, yes.
And count all the nuclei inside.
This is the utmost.
The quantum
height is 0.5 micron. So it's closer to the number. But I don't know how quickly, how fast is the diffusion occurs within the seconds. So we need to solve the rate equation more carefully.
It sort of works. You need to know the diffusion constant.
And it's not constant spatially.
Well, yeah.
Right, because of the hyperfine interactions and the quantum level and all that stuff.
Well, there's also the issue of the non-resonant condition. The resonant frequency is different from the place versus the other. So
yeah,
that's an issue. But even leaving aside that, I think there's very little agreement on the diffusion constant.
And you've
got a ballpark, accepted ballpark person. I mean, for example, in heterostructures, the diffusion constants that have been measured are all considerably smaller by at least an order of magnitude than the bulk Gallium arsenide measurement, but I'm not aware of the very few measurements.
So thank you very much for all of your suggestions.
Do you have still energy enough for the second talk?
I have enough energy, but if you need a break.
You don't need a break?
I don't need a quick break.
Yeah.
Jared, break is something which is illogical.
Yeah.
It's what? It's illogical. Well,
Okay.
How should we interpret the Rabi oscillations? Is this of the nuclei you mentioned?
Yeah.
Is this the Rabi oscillation of a single nucleus, or should we sort of just see that we have some oscillations?
Rabi is the only associated with gallium 71.
With what?
Gallium 71. Only one species.
Yes, but so Rabi oscillation means that really something which is fully quantum mechanical.
Yes.
So I would then say, okay, this you can have if you have a single nuclear spin. But is it what you see? I think it's not just a single one, right?
We cannot.
It's a sort of it's an ensemble of again 10 to the 5/5 or so.
Yes.
And then it becomes classical again.
Yes, yes.
Is that correct? That we can interpret just that we have the microscopic moment of this ensemble of spins which is precessing or.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
So what keeps. Is this commonly seen? Rabi oscillations of nuclear spins?
Not commonly observed. For two-dimensional electron gas associated with H3s, Hirayama-san and Machida-san, for example.
So that means that many nuclei, either something holds the nuclei together so that they behave collectively, or they all see the same field, right?
Yeah, so they see one coherent field probably, right? Is it, so it's more or less a question, of course. What is quantum, what is semi-classical? Yeah. And I had a discussion with Daniel Loss also, the Spin accumulation. And you see a precession of the Spin accumulation, should this be interpreted as quantum mechanics or type of Ravi oscillation, so it's just the semi-classical spin, which is fascinating. This is my question. So how do you see this? How is this?
Exactly speaking, we should say that it's pretty difficult to distinguish experimentally what if this is a quantum mechanical plasma. Because you see, I think you say experimentally, maybe it's difficult to observe some interference effect. But actually, it's pretty difficult to understand. You can apply the quantum mechanical theory and classical theory to interpret the observed
oscillation. But it is something which is rather robust.
But this is very important, very crucial for the concept of the projection mechanics to interface. In the moment, my family is not very much depressed because the Japanese team lost the game.
But isn't just going to the World Cup itself a big accomplishment? Right? I mean, Japan went to the World Cup, right?
Yeah. After the World Cup came in Japan 4 years ago, mm-hmm. people are only interested in this World Cup games only at this time. Maybe 6 months before they forget.
You should tell your family it would have been worse. They could have lost 3-0. Some other country did.
So your whole family is interested in soccer?
At least my wife and my younger son. But they influence the whole family. Strong enough.
A strong motivation for me to come to this place is to escape from all of that.
all of Holland and Germany are crazy about it. Here we don't even know that World Cup is going on. I don't know if you can have touch or something, right? In this building, at least.
Yeah, but still, in the university center, they do have a big screen and
the university center.
And you cannot eat your sandwich quietly because all these people are screaming.
Oh, be Brazil, the slunch.
With your dancing and screaming.
Should we stop?
Yeah, I have the feeling that Alan
has. Not everybody make a pass.
Not taking me around.
Okay, let me start. For my second topic, I'd like to show some our recent experimental data on the Kondo effect on G-factor anisotropy observed in a single self-assembled indium arsenide quantum dot. We started this work very recently. We started the work last February. We do not have so many data, so maybe I will not trap you for a long time. But the indium arsenide quantum dots are interesting system because of the interest for applications to quantum dot lasers and the single photon sources. And the physical properties are mainly studied using a technique of optical spectroscopy. And here in this, in our work, we make an electrical contact to a single self-assembled uncapped indium arsenide quantum dot. I will first show you some fabrication of a nanogap, so-called nanogap electrode for an uncapped indium arsenide quantum dot placed on the gallium arsenide substrate and show some observation of the Kondo effect in a single self-assembled indium arsenide quantum dot, which is probably the first observation of the system. And we observe a large anisotropy of electron G factor in the experiment of the Kondo effect. And finally, I'll discuss somewhat about the B field, magnetic field induced reconstruction of electronic configuration in a 3D-like quantum dot feature. Here is a list of our collaborators. Igarashi is one of my graduate students who is mainly working on this topic. And we collaborate with the group of Professor Hirakawa and the Professor Machida in Tokyo University. The PhD student, Jun, is the main contributor also in this work. So then, when you think about the electrode contact to semiconductor nanostructures, this is usually done through the conductive semiconductor quantum dot because quantum dots are embedded or capped in semiconductor systems. So then we have a quantum dot here at the heterogeneous interface between the gallium arsenide and N-type aluminum gallium arsenide. This quantum dot is connected to the electron gas as a reservoir. And put the normal metal, which has the contact to the 2D electron gas. So then, this kind of system is good to study the charge effects and the coherence effect as well. And the tunnel injection of the spin can also be done when you use some ferromagnetic metal instead of the normal metal. However, if we can use a direct metal contact to an uncapped quantum dot, this will be more useful to study the transport of the coherent states and injection of the magnetic moment. We can study the Kondo effect for the spin coherence and supercurrent injection if we use a superconducting metal. We can also study the efficient injection of magnetic moment if we use a ferromagnetic metal. These kind of studies are mainly done for a very specific system, such as the carbon nanotubes and indium arsenide nanowires, but not very much for some orthodox quantum dots. We tried to use an uncapped self-assembled indium arsenide quantum dot to make it a direct metal contact to study the electronic properties of a single quantum dot. Well, there is some problem when you think about the fabrication of the electrical contact to a single self-assembled quantum dot, because usually the areal density of a self-assembled quantum dot is pretty high, because this is all made by a growth technique, so-called, using a Stransky-Krasnov mold. And previously, we prepared a single electron transistor containing a couple of the indium arsenide quantum dots. And just by using some kind of the gating technique to pick up the single indium arsenide quantum dot and observe the shell fillings. And there are other techniques by using the quantum point contact and also on AFM techniques to access a single indium arsenide quantum dots. Here we use a nanogap contact to make a tunnel connection to a uncapped quantum dot. So here is a CM picture of our quantum dot device. Here we have a pretty large indium arsenide self-assembled quantum dots. So there are many small indium arsenide self-assembled quantum dots. So these are white spots. And we put the titanium gold metal contact, which is partly climbing up the side of the dot. And then the direct contact is prepared from between this electrode metal and this quantum dot. And then we have a quantum dot having two contact leads and all made on the same insulating gallium arsenide. And through a insulating aluminum gallium arsenide, we have an N-type gallium arsenide substrate to change the electrostatic potential of the quantum dot. And we usually observe this kind of a nice Coulomb blockade oscillations. Here is a S-type shell filling, and here four peaks indicating the P-type shell filling. And the way is to find out the device having the lower contact resistance in order to observe the Kondo effect. The Kondo effect is very popular, so then I can skip this picture. And what's the signatures of the observation of the Kondo effect? The easiest way is to measure the temperature, the Coulomb oscillations at different temperatures. When the temperature is lower than the so-called Kondo temperature, the Coulomb valley holding odd number of electrons is grows. And finally reaches the value of 2e squared over h in the unitary limit. This does not occur for the Coulomb valley holding even number of electrons. And if you fix the gate voltage here in the somewhere in the Coulomb valley and measure the differential conductance as a function of source drain, you see a so-called zero bias anomaly, which is a signature of the Kondo density of states aligned to the Fermi level in the conduct. And if you plot the peak conductance at the zero bias anomaly as a function of temperature, this shows a very typical log T dependence. And when you apply the magnetic field, the Kondo anomaly will split into two peaks because of the Zeeman energy. Okay, let's try the experiments. Our data are not very much elaborated, but this is the Coulomb peak for the electron number of 3, 4, and 5. But Coulomb valley holding 3 electrons and 5 electrons, the conductance goes up as the temperature is decreased from 800 mK down to 30 mK. But this doesn't occur for the Coulomb valley holding just 4 electrons. And here is the color scale plot of the differential conductance in the plane of the source drain voltage and the gate voltage. The red is the high conductance region. White and blue are both low conductance region. So usually we have a white region between the red high conductance region due to the Coulomb blockade. However, for the Coulomb valley holding 3 electrons, in the center along the zero source drain voltage, we see a very sharp line indicating the lifting of the partial lifting of the Coulomb blockade. This is the Kondo resonance. If you look at carefully the data, there is some small line here in the center for the Coulomb valley holding 5 electrons. And when you plot the peak conductance in this center line, you see a nice log T dependence showing the effect of the Kondo. And then you can evaluate the Kondo temperature of around 2 Kelvin in this case. And if source drain voltage is the voltage applied between these two electrodes.
Gate is
here, beneath. Okay, and then if you apply the in-plane magnetic field, the Zeeman splitting occurs, which gives a splitting of the Kondo valley. At 1 Tesla, you have a splitting of about 0.4 millivolt, which is equivalent to 4K, already larger than the Kondo temperature energy. So we cannot expect the Kondo for 1 Tesla magnetic field. Here is a plot of the differential conductance as a function of source drain voltage and the magnetic field. At the low magnetic field region, there's no splitting. And the voltage, source drain voltage, is still smaller than the Kondo temperature. So we are still in the regime of the Kondo. However, above 0.5 Tesla, we see a very nice splitting of the Kondo resonance. And this is the regime of the inelastic cotoning, which occurs when the source drain voltage is greater than the Zeeman energy. Here is a very schematic picture to explain what's going on in this inelastic cotoning regime. We have a spin down up state for the ground state, with the excited state having the electrons spin down. And if we have applied the source drain voltage, which is equivalent or greater than the Zeeman energy, the electron from the source come to the excited state, and the electron spin in the ground state is scattered to the drain. The energy difference of Zeeman energy is compensated for by this source drain voltage energy. So then in elastic coupling is activated pretty much. But exactly from this peak spacing changing with magnetic field, we can precisely evaluate the G factor. So then the G factor evaluated is 3.8 plus minus 0.5 for the electron number of 3 and 5, which is pretty much different from that of the bulk indium arsenide. The G factor is minus 15 for bulk indium arsenide.
It's a question of the confinement?
It's a question of confinement, yes. And to evaluate, another way is to evaluate the G factor precisely is to measure the so-called excitation spectrum. If we usually apply very small source drain voltage to measure the so-called Coulomb oscillations to pick up the ground state only. But if we apply the finite voltage, we can observe the Coulomb peaks not only associated with the ground state, but also with the excited states. So here is an experimental data for this excitation spectrum, or the differential conductance as a function of source drain voltage, only in the positive polarity, as a function, and also the gate voltage. See, this is the ground state, the lower one. Sum up above, there is another line, which is an excited state. The separation between these two lines is a measure of the Zeeman energy, and the separation becomes larger and larger as the magnetic field is increased. And from this measurement, we can also precisely evaluate G factor of 3.7. This is the case for one electron. For one electron, we did not observe the Condor effect because the one electron state is very much confined inside the quantum dot. The Condor resistance is pretty large. We have no chance to see the Condor effect. This is the case when apply the field perpendicular to the plane of the substrate. So we at the 0 Tesla, we see a nice Condor peak for the Coulomb body holding 9 electrons. And apply the magnetic field, application of magnetic field gives a splitting of the Condor resonance. Now, when we look at the data of the 1 Tesla, the peak separation is now 0.9 millitesla. In the previous view graph, we did the same experiment, but for the in-plane magnetic field. The peak spacing separation is 0.4 millivolts at the same magnetic field. So this means the Zeeman splitting is much greater when we apply the perpendicular magnetic field. When we plot the Zeeman energy as a function magnetic field, we can get the G factor of now 8.2, which is a bit less than half the bulk value.
Can you tell us the right size of the dots?
The base diameter is 90 nanometers. And we see already some facet. So if this is a very reasonable facet, this angle will be between 50 and 60 degrees. Pretty much.
So 30 nanometers high.
Yeah.
These are huge.
It's huge dot. Huge dot is good for us to make contact. I said the charging energy plus and the single particle level of space in total is maybe between 5 and 10 millielectron volts.
Do you have data for higher fields?
Yeah, I will later come to you. Here is the measurement of angle dependence of G factor. the data is not very clean, but we change the angle of the direction of the magnetic field. At the 0 degree, the field is perpendicular to the surface of the plane. Then we can follow the splitting of the condor Gilbert anomalies, which gives a measure of the Zeeman energy. The splitting becomes smaller and smaller when we increase this angle, indicating the reduction of the G factor. So then we plot the G factor as a function of angle. So G factor, in this case, the G factor changes from probably minus 8.8 down to minus 4.5 when we change the angle from 0 down to 90 degrees. And this is this calculation using this kind of a simple formula, which is frequently used to analyze data, assuming the G perpendicular and G power.
What is the theta sub 0?
Theta sub 0 is the, because we are not very sure the 0 degree, where we are 0 degree. This is some kind of adjust parameter, mm-hmm. and a small adjustment, a few degree.
What's the orientation of the
azimuth? This surface is 100. But we already have a facet on the side. But this facet is not well identified, to be precise. It's pretty difficult. To see the angle is pretty difficult. But if this is the reasonable facet, maybe it's 56 degrees. But this is still influenced by the strain. So it's pretty difficult.
If
we assume this angle, we can identify, but we cannot identify the measure the angle itself. This is just a guess.
Does that mean it's be coming out of the facet or out of the corner?
I see. I understand now. I understand. We don't know, actually. Yeah, I don't know. I should ask my students.
Do you know the composition of the dot? Is it pure indium arsenide or is
it helium
or
the top region will be indium arsenide, but the lower region we have some diffusion of gallium. So the lower part may be indium gallium arsenide, but you don't know the component fraction, if you will.
So this kind of observation is sampling independent.
What do you say? We do not have the exactly the same quantum dot. Sometimes 90 nanometer or 85, it's pretty difficult to say. We initially measure this kind of a dot shape by scanning electron microscope and put that sample into the cluster to measure. We are sure that we measure this dot, but see, we can see roughly the baseline length of the 90 nanometer, but in the other dot also show the similar shape, but we cannot say whether this is 85 or 90, but the roughly the shape or the geometry is the same, 90.
The data you present is for one dot.
One dot.
And most likely, if you take a similar dot,
Data
will be similar, but it will not be exactly the same.
Not exactly the same, because when you like to rotate your sample, you have to ask warm up and change the device. This is some of cycling gives some change of the characteristics of the device itself. So every time when you heat up, you in principle have different devices. But the G factor is more or less the same.
Have you done measurements for several such lines?
No, most two devices, but not more.
How did you determine the sign here?
Sign? Minus. No, we didn't determine. We are expecting our dot is pretty large. The G factor must be closer to that of the bulk. The bulk with G factor is minus 15. So if it's positive, it's a plus 8.5. It's very strange value. This is lambda G factor.
Is it possible to get a G factor which is larger than 2 at all?
No, I think this will
not. Not in common semiconductors, put it that way.
Yeah.
You could think of some odd material, but I don't know whether it exists in nature.
I will show something about the difference in the G factor for a capped quantum dot and uncapped quantum dot. The capped quantum dot is prepared just by embedding indium arsenide quantum dot in gallium arsenide or aluminum arsenide. So then Krasnov mode is working, and due to the strain, the small quantum dot is usually formed with a baseline of 20 to 30 nanometer and the height of 3 or 4 nanometer. The dot size is pretty tiny. And also there is a significant amount of diffusion of gallium or aluminum into the quantum dots. And the wave function penetrates into the surrounding material. If the surrounding is gallium arsenide, the G factor is minus 0.44. But if it's aluminum arsenide, the G factor is plus 2. And then the G factor can be either positive or negative depending on the surrounding material. If you have an aluminum arsenide, G factor can be positive. And also, this capped quantum dot suffers from a very strong strain. However, we use an uncapped quantum dot placed on the gallium arsenide substrate. The sample dot size is pretty large. And diffusion, of course, we have a diffusion, but it only occurs in the lower part of the quantum dots. The strain effect may be a bit smaller than that for a capped quantum dot. The G factor can be closer to the bulk value of minus 15. Now there are already a few experiments on the G factor for a capped indium arsenide quantum dots by gallium arsenide. Here is a report from the group of Hanover, and they measure the G factor as a function of a tilt angle of the magnetic field. They claim the G factor observed is positive, changes from 0.74 to 0.92. When the magnetic field is perpendicular to the plane, the G factor becomes smaller in the negative direction. So this means if you consider that the reduction of the G factor from 2 down to the negative direction due to the stronger spin orbit coupling, the result is pretty much consistent with our experiment. There is always also a calculation using a K dot P theory by the NRC group for indium arsenide quantum dot in gallium arsenide. And the experiment is done for indium arsenide quantum dot in aluminum arsenide. And the calculation says that for this kind of a quantum dot, the G factor changes from minus 0.5 to minus 2.2. And the G factor is smaller negative for the magnetic field perpendicular to the plane. This is contradictory with our experiment. So we don't know what's going on. So then that's the discussion of the G factor. Now we come to the effect of the strong magnetic field. So as I said, anyway, for our large quantum dot, the G factor is pretty large, so we can expect a pretty large Zeeman effect. And for example, for the in-plane magnetic field, we already have a 0.9 mEV per Tesla. And for Gallium-Arsenide quantum dot, the Zeeman energy is just 0.02 mEV per Tesla. The more or less say 40 times greater for our indium arsenide quantum dot as compared to that for gallium arsenide quantum dot. And the charging energy plus the single particle level spacing ranges from 5 to 7 mEV. So this means if you apply the magnetic field greater than 5 Tesla, Zeeman energy will dominate everything. So Zeeman induced transition can be expected. And also in addition, we have a large dot size, not only in the lateral direction, but also in the perpendicular direction. So then we expect that the confinement is no more two-dimensional. This must be three-dimensional. So there's some three-dimensional electronic configuration can reduce the Coulomb energy, particularly in the high magnetic field. So now let's try the experiments. The data are not so good, but this is the experimental data showing the evolution of the Coulomb peaks in somewhat blue or some red with in-plane magnetic field. It's pretty difficult to see. We have a first peak here.
Where exactly?
If you come here. Okay, sorry. But if you believe me, I can give you the guides to forward trace the Coulomb peaks. So most of the peaks, the peak spacing will either becomes larger and smaller alternately. So this is the filling of the consecutive filling of the antiparallel spins. And the Zeeman is dominating. So there is some small kink due to the Zeeman induced single triple transitions. Also, there is another kink also due to the Zeeman induced level crossing. This is the similar data but measured for the application of a perpendicular magnetic field. Again, we have some one electron here. So then if we trace, the feature is quite similar to that for the case with the in-plane magnetic field. But there are some difference in the peak shift. So for example, this peak goes down, this peak goes up, reflecting the orbital effect. And for larger electron numbers, these two Zeeman and orbital contribute to the level crossing. Level crossing occurs at the repulsive region. But if we are interested in that thing, when we apply some magnetic field, the two levels come too close to each other very much. The Coulomb gap is reduced pretty much at some particular level crossing point. This is the same device but measured after the thermal cycling with the perpendicular magnetic field. You see the very strong reduction of the Coulomb gap at this crossing point. this particularly occurs in the high magnetic field region. This is usually not the case for the capped Indy Marsh-Nyder quantum dots. And this is the Coulomb peaks evolving with magnetic field, but measured for the tiny indium arsenide quantum dots embedded in gallium arsenide in the material. So you see the evolution of the Coulomb peaks. Here is a P shell filling, one is S shell filling. And see the, even at the crossing, anti-crossing point, Coulomb gap stays more or less constant, which is well explained just by taking into account the constant interaction plus exchange energy. And there are already a couple of calculations just by taking into account the two-dimensional confinement, which is assumed for the lens-shaped or pyramid-shaped quantum dot, but the size is pretty tiny. So as far as these are calculations are concerned, we cannot expect any kind of the strong reduction of the Coulomb gap in the magnetic field. So then, we are expecting, this is also a hand-waving discussion, initially at the zero magnetic field, the two-dimensional confinement will be important to construct the electronic configuration. However, at some magnetic field, the three-dimensional electronic configuration will become important to reduce the Coulomb gap. So then we can observe such a strong reduction of the Coulomb gap at the high magnetic field region. So now this is the end of my talk. We use the electronic spectroscopy technique to study the electronic properties of single uncapped indium arsenide quantum dots. The spin half quantum effect is clearly observed for this uncapped indium arsenide quantum dot holding just a few electrons. This is probably the first observation on this system. The electron G factor shows large anisotropy, probably due to the anisotropic spin orbit coupling. The angle dependence of the G factor is not very much consistent with theory for capped indium arsenide quantum dot. We do not know the reason why. And the evolution of the electronic state with magnetic field is strongly dominated by the Zeeman effect. And interestingly, at the high magnetic field, the significant reduction of Coulomb gap is observed. We think of the contribution of reconstruction of electronic configuration in the 3D confinement. Thank you very much. Sorry, one more slide. what we like to do is that after Condor, we are now already making a quantum dot with a superconducting electrodes and ferromagnetic electrodes on top of the indium arsenide quantum dot. So this is we use more or less the same technique as made for a nanotubes and nanowires. And in that case, for superconducting electrodes, we have a Cooper pair. The Cooper pair will be injected into the indium arsenide quantum dot. And at the same time, or we can inject the holes from the p-type, the gallium arsenide the layer, into the quantum dot. This can generate entangled photons. So we are expecting to generate a tunstall operation of the entangled photon pairs. Thank you very much. Okay. Yeah.
So the uncolored dots have a significant strain distribution. They're strained at the bottom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The how about the angle dependence? The angle that we are are concerned about the angle dependence in the calculation, k dot p calculation for cap dot has a less negative g factor for the magnetic field perpendicular to the plane, and a large negative g factor for the in-plane magnetic field. This is completely opposite in that direction. We have a large g factor in the perpendicular magnetic field, large negative and small negative in the in-plane.
Well, in calculations you showed and in calculations I've done, the dots being considered much flatter and smaller too. Mm-hmm. So from the splitting, suppressing, mixing valence band states, you expect that behavior. But for these dots being so large and the electron being pushed up towards a region that has very low strain, the effect of heavy white hole splitting would be much less, so that effect would be smaller. Why it would go the other way isn't completely clear. Certainly, the effect that in the other dots drives the analytic optical the way it does would be vastly different in the other dots.
The factor are similar to what the Foldikov has been observed in gallium arsenide quantum torques in the pool.
In the arsenide, in gallium arsenide.
By the same group in analog.
Yeah, but this is in the arsenide quantum, but in aluminum arsenide. The G factor is positive.
The anisotropy of the G factor in gallium arsenide quantum dot, or of a double barrier structure. Both gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide, gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide, gallium arsenide.
The quantum dot or quantum well or quantum dot?
It was the small size quantum well. So it was a pillar. And the tunneling went to localized states. And the sign of the effect was the same. So that the spin splitting is a perpendicular field. Was stronger than in the in-plane field.
Yeah, but I think we did a couple of experiments on the G factor and I saw the in gallium arsenide quantum dots embedded in the pillar. Our result means that the anisotropy is pretty small.
Yeah.
But pretty small. Pretty small.
The G factor is already much smaller.
Yeah, 0.
The orbit coupling effects are weaker in gallium arsenide, where the difference is small. But when it was necessary to explain that, it was necessary to take into account that there is, of course, spin orbit coupling due to Dresselhaus effect building to the band structure. And also, you have anisotropy which is not strongly in your control, which is due to Rasbetterian, which is due to the geometrical symmetry and charge distribution, electric field distribution. So basically, the analysis on the level of phenology can appeal to two terms, Dresselhaus plus Rasbach, with the size of those two contributions unknown. And then you can get either positive or negative change in the G factor and anisotropy, depending on which one predominates.
Yes.
I mean, the Dresselhaus and Rasbach term are certainly not contribution to the Zeeman's splitting in a strict sense, but they give you
it gives anisotropy of the splitting.
They give you a splitting or a modification of the energy levels as a function of magnetic field, but in a strict sense, if you look at the functional form of the terms, it's not a Zeeman term, but
well, for weak fields, they are linear.
But it's not a Zeeman term because it's
for weak fields, the you can expand the field, you get linear contribution, which can be interpreted as a G factor or
No. It's always a mixture for those terms. It's always a mixture of orbital effects and
whatever you say.
No. You can't turn a k-linear term into something like that into a Zeeman term.
You
a Zeeman term has no orbital effect by definition.
You can't. I have another question.
Yeah.
How the spin splitting, which you interpret in terms of G factor,
depends on the size of the out-of-plane magnetic field. So this anisotropy, does it saturate when you increase the field? In Hanover experiments, it was observed that if you go to higher fields, of course it was easier to do that because the size of spin splitting was very small, it did not interplay with charging. But it was observed that in weak fields, you can treat it as the it's two different G factors, perpendicular parallel, but then the difference between in and out of plane spin splitting saturated.
High magnetic
field.
In our case, if you...
Well, I can explain you why it happens in a quasi-two-dimensional interpretation.
So up to, we measure only up to 3 tesla.
Oh,
because the line is pretty straight. So there's no
linear. To about 10 tesla.
We haven't measured yet for
the
10 tesla.
They went to the regime when, the linear regime is when the magnetic shift of the orbital state is still the magnetic shift. When you start getting linear dependence of the orbital energy on magnetic field, so when you start getting Landau levels, then the anisotropy saturates. This actually gives you the effective magnetic field due to spin orbit coupling.
Maybe we need the magnetic field higher than 5 or 6 tesla. In that sense, the...
You mean the magnetic field which will give you about the
I think
size of the confined state in terms of the magnetic length.
We measure up to 8 tesla for the in-plane field and perpendicular field. So this one, for example, it goes up.
This already highly excited states.
It's 9 electrons. 10 electrons.
No, I'm talking about the states in the bottom, which are easier to interpret because wave functions are very well defined.
The 1 or 2 electron case.
Yeah.
I think we can also evaluate the shift of the peaks, but we have not yet done.
So what I'm saying is that there should be a strong correlation between the magnetic shift and the way how G factor, well, spin splitting behaves. So if the magnetic shift is quadratic in magnetic field, then the spin splitting is linear in magnetic field. And when you start getting the Landau level behavior, magnetic shift becomes linear in magnetic field, then the spin splitting would, the difference in spin splitting would saturate.
I think we can distinguish that effect if we measure the, for example, the excited the state at the same time. One electron ground state, one electron excited state with different spins, but with the same orbitals. So the excitation energy is a measure of Zeeman.
In states, this will probably happen earlier, but it's a smaller field.
But maybe the one electron state, we can probably measure the excited states, which excitation energy is only determined by the Zeeman term. Not orbital terms are both included into the ground and excited states. We have not yet done it.
One more question concerning this figure. When you say that for the left part you have only a Zeeman effect and for the right part you have Zeeman plus orbital. If you just compare the different dimensions to the magnetic length that you have for these magnetic fields, is this consistent or how do you come up with this distinction that the left figure for the in-plane field only shows
the Zeeman?
Zeeman, and why do you not expect orbital effects also for the in-plane magnetic field?
We have not yet analyzed the data yet, but I think we can analyze the data because we know the G factor already, and we maybe we can estimate the change of the peak spacing, which is only due to the constant G factor or some deviation from the constant G factor calculation. Because we assume that peak spacing, for example, these two peaks decreases and these peak increases because of the only the Zeeman term. And then we can calculate the contribution of the Zeeman energy and then distinguish whether we have a contribution of the orbital term or not.
My question was slightly different, whether this is essentially what you expect based on the geometry of your system, that for the in-plane magnetic field you do not see the orbital effect, whereas for the perpendicular field, does it reflect what you expect for the system?
For 4 or 5 Tesla, up to 4 or 5 Tesla, maybe yes. But the difficulty is that we do not know exactly the effective conducting area, the electron area, region of the quantum dot. We of course apply the in-plane, but this can influence the orbital part. But exactly, we have to know the size of the effective height to discuss the precisely. So that in that sense, whether we see a lambda-like shift or not, this is a kind of measure. So up to 4 or 5 Tesla, the line shifts more or less linearly with magnetic field, that we are expecting that only due to the Zeeman term, mainly. So in the moment, we do not know exactly what's the contribution. So. Now 4:30 in the morning.